Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 108. Today the Amateur Traveler goes to Portugal. Hear why our guest says you shouldn't join the rest of the tourists at the Algarve.
I got my bags packed and on a roll. I'm heading out there and I'm ready to go. Looking real good in my passport photo.
Oh no.
15-hour flight, oh, I don't think I'll ever be coming home. You know I love it. One more cathedral, I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not today.
Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. The first news story I have for you today is from an article in the New York Times called No Suitcase is Safe, about what happens to your luggage when things go missing or your luggage itself doesn't show up. There's a recent study that came out from the Transportation Security Administration, and being a government agency and right up on top of things, they ranked airports based on their data, which comes from 2004, and they rank that the worst airport for getting your luggage through is Los Angeles International Airport with 1,458 claims in the year 2004, followed by O'Hare in Chicago with 963, and then Seattle-Tacoma actually took third place, which surprised me. Check out that article. The bottom line is, if you really want it to go with you, make sure it's in your carry-on luggage. And if it doesn't fit in your carry-on luggage and you're really afraid of losing it, leave it at home. Many of you by now have heard about the Strand-In that took place in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago. If I can read from an article from the Chicago Tribune. On Wednesday afternoon, Melissa Wheeler acted out the role of flight attendant. She paused down the grassy aisle in a makeshift airplane and informed a passenger the pretzels were gone. Behind her, a CD player blasted typical airplane sounds. A howling baby, a beeping seatbelt sign, the muffled garble of the captain's speech. The scene took place at Wednesday's Strand-In on the National Mall between the U.S. Capitol and the Washington Monument, where irate passengers tried to simulate conditions of a stranded airplane inside a gray tent. Black duct tape stood for wings, and brown plastic folding chairs took the place of cramped airplane seats. The demonstration was sponsored by the Coalition for an Airplane Passengers' Bill of Rights, a group of frustrated travelers who are pushing for federal legislation that sets a 3-hour limit on grounded delays. After that time, a plane sitting on the tarmac for 3 hours would have to return to the terminal. So basically, they were trying to get senators and congressmen to show up on their mock plane and show them what it's like to be on the conditions that people have had to endure over the last few years, and especially that have become very public in the last year. I will put an link in the show notes to this article from the Chicago Tribune that I just read from, as well as to the invitation that went out to the congressman, which is on the Coalition for an Airline Passengers Bill of Rights blog, as well as a link for the Coalition for Airline Passengers Bill of Rights. So check those out if you fly it or you're at all interested in that particular issue. And all of those links can be found at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome to the show Catherine, who is coming to us from both Portugal, which is where she has grown up, as well as a company, Cycling Through the Centuries, which does bicycle trips around mostly Portugal and Spain.
Yeah, that's correct. Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Now, the first thing we have to establish, and you and I talked about this a little before we going, I was a little confused because I thought you had grown up in Portugal, but you speak just like I do.
I know. So. It's very confusing for, believe me, not only you, but for me. No, I was born in Brazil and then moved to Portugal. My father is Brazilian and my mother's American. And I've been in Portugal since I was about 5 years old. So, and I went to briefly to Portuguese schools and then to international schools, which were English speaking. And I think my mother must have just had the bigger influence in my life.
But Portugal is home.
Portugal is most definitely home. If I root for a football team, it's Portugal. If I root for a rugby team, it's Portugal.
Okay. So if we're going to Portugal, and I appreciate you coming on and talking about Portugal, it's someplace I haven't been and would love to go. We tried to fit it into a trip to Spain, but we were already seeing too much as it is. What should we plan for Portugal? Let's say we have just about a 2-week trip, which is kind of typical for most of the listeners here. What do you see?
Portugal is fantastic because it's quite small, mm-hmm. very small, and it has a huge range from north to south, but it's only got about a 350-kilometer width. So you can actually see almost everything in 2 weeks if you plan well, like any trip. But there is so much to see. And if I was going to recommend, I would start in Lisbon,
okay.
which is a fantastic city, the capital. It's kind of, to me, like a it's kind of like an old man, you know. It's a bit tattered around the edges, but still quite elegant and sort of noble. And it's a very safe city. I think it's at the moment rated the safest city in Europe. The crime rate in Portugal is very low.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
So it's very easy to walk around in at night, and it's just a very comfortable, cozy city. And it's beautiful. There's the fado, the Portuguese music, which now they've just recently made a movie about. And it's singing of sorrow and unrequited love and the sailors going out to sea, you know, when they would go out for the discoveries and perhaps never returning. And it's very deep, heartfelt music. And most of the people who sing the music started off singing on the streets of Lisbon. And a lot of them still today don't know how to read or write, but they can sing this fantastic poetry that's just been passed down from generation to generation. So I would definitely go to a fado club in Lisbon and listen to some fado. And there are the trams. There's so much to do in Lisbon. It's pastries, everything. I could name many, many monuments.
Now, as we talk about the way the city looks, geographically, I hear it often compared to San Francisco for Americans.
It is. Well, you've got kind of the first thing that would strike you as somebody from California would probably be our bridge, the 25th of April. You might notice a resemblance to your Golden Gate Bridge due to the fact that it was also built by U.S. Steel. Mm-hmm. So it's almost identical. And it's also very hilly. The idea is that Lisbon's built on seven hills, but it seems more like 20 or 40 to me. And it's got a fantastic castle that overlooks, but in the sense of very steep, windy streets and the trams going up and down, I suppose, yeah, in that sense, it would be a bit like San Francisco.
And as we look at Lisbon, the tour books are going to recommend that I go to the different monuments and a few key museums and cathedrals and such. Anything that really stands out as, well, everybody goes there, but it wouldn't be on your list. Don't take your friends there.
Well, I would choose my fado club very, very carefully because you can get easily scammed and sort of taken into a place where the food is extortionate, not particularly good, and the music's crummy. So that needs to be selected very carefully. And the best guidebook that I've seen for that sort of thing is Rick Steves.
Okay.
At least what I've read in his part about Lisbon and what he recommends, it's quite sort of accurate. And in terms of monuments to visit, I don't think there's any one in the guidebook that I would say was not worthwhile, that I wouldn't take somebody to.
Okay.
Actually, I can think of a monument in Lisbon. The Tower of Belém. It's this little tiny tower. It's very cute. Sits on the water. But absolutely not worth visiting at all. And people queue up for miles to go visit this castle, this little tower thing. It's not worth it.
Okay.
But otherwise, no, I can't think of anything.
And then the flip side, they're queuing up for hours to see that, and what they're really missing, which is right around the corner, is what?
Oh, the Coach Museum. Fantastic. There's a wonderful little... Actually, it is right around the corner. And it's not really visited. It's in the old, where the horses would train, the royal horses mm-hmm. of the monarchy would train. It's a closed sort of stable. And they've got the coach museum there. And I got absolutely fabulous coaches. It's well worth it.
Okay.
It perhaps won't say much about Portugal, but there are absolutely stunning coaches. And you won't see them anywhere else in the world. So.
Okay. Anything else we want to see in Lisbon, or would it be time then for us to move on after a couple days, 3 days?
I think 3 days in Lisbon would be a comfortable, relaxed time in Lisbon, because you're right on the water. There's the Expo. There was the Expo 98 in Lisbon, and they've done that area up very well. We've got, I think, biggest, a rather strange thing to visit perhaps when you're in Portugal, but it's one of the biggest aquariums, and it really is beautiful. And the whole area around there, and they've renovated the dock area, a bit like San Francisco as well in that sense, so that they've got sort of fun African restaurants and nightclubs, and it's good to go to kind of an African nightclub. That's something I would recommend, but a lot of tourists perhaps wouldn't do. They might feel intimidated or something, but they're a lot of fun. These Cabo Verde, because of the colonies, you know, we have lots of Africans, and it's a lot of fun to go to their nightclubs and to go to listen to the music. They always have live bands playing, and the dancing's fantastic, and the food's delicious.
Okay, great. And then what's our next stop?
Sintra, which is just north. It's about 20 kilometers north of Lisbon. And it's a tiny little gem tucked away in the hills. And it's fantastic because it's got a microclimate all of its own. And when you're coming back from Lisbon in the evening, in the summers, these clouds start to settle over the hills. And it looks like somebody just began pouring yogurt topping all over the mountains as they start to sort of come down. And so it creates huge amounts of condensation in the area. So it's very lush, very green, complete tiny little microclimate. And you get these ferns, and the walls are always covered in moss. And it's a beautiful area. And Lord Byron spent a lot of time in Sintra. He didn't think much of the Portuguese, but he really liked Sintra.
He probably enjoyed the port, I would imagine.
Yeah. He wrote a very good poem about the... Well, it's not a very good poem at all. It's a terrible poem about the Portuguese, but it's quite funny. He said that they're liars from the cradle, thief when able, peacock in the street, steal from another man's table, and I can't remember the rest. So they didn't have a very good opinion of him. He was kind of a toffee Englishman, but the Portuguese are nothing like that. But Sintra is wonderful anyway, so they have, and that's where there was the summer residence of the royalty. Originally, the Moors had their summer residence there, and then later on, the Christian royalty. And so you have sort of two palaces, and then a Moorish castle, and these manor houses over manor houses. And it's just beautiful. I mean, there's so much to visit. It's probably one of the most romantic spots, I think, there is.
Okay.
And it's got, you know, sort of steeped in history, and not all, a lot of it dates from the Romantic period. So you have some of these huge manor houses, which are done in the sort of the Mozarabic style, but they were built in the 18th century. And they put in sort of fake ruins to make it look more romantic. And they
fake
put in sort of
ruins
fake
to make it,
tunnels.
Okay.
And it sounds awful. It sounds almost like Disney World, but somehow it works. Like a little fake ruin of a chapel or something.
Okay.
Yeah, these sort of romantic period types. But it is. It's beautiful. And at the time, if you were a foreigner living in Portugal, you know, it was like the life of Riley.
Interesting.
People had money. And one particular place apparently had 60 gardeners, you know. And,
interesting.
You know, people would take their hats off whenever a foreigner would walk by, and cars were very rare, so they would lift their hats whenever foreigners would walk by. And still today in some parts of the countryside, you see a little bit of that attitude.
Well, we know that Lord Byron had a poor impression of the Portuguese, you tell us, but one Englishman I know who had a much higher opinion was Lord Wellington,
yes,
who really missed them at the Battle of Waterloo, his Portuguese allies who he had fought beside for years against Napoleon. So
I know, if it wasn't for him, who knows, we'd be speaking French. No, the Portuguese have a long relationship with the English. They are the oldest allies in Europe, supposedly. And Portugal's actually got the oldest border in Europe, fixed border in Europe. Portugal has been Portugal since the 14th century, so 13-something, I can't remember the exact date. They've been an established country for a long time, and you can feel that without sort of strife and these sort of districts or regions that want to be autonomous and so on. They've been a united country for a long time, and they've had this relationship with England. The port industry is dominated by the English, and some say that it wouldn't be the industry it is if it wasn't for the English. They have lots of land in the interior of Portugal. There's lots of old English, Anglo, sort of Lusitanian families. So there's a lot of strong relationships. Going back to Sintra, I would say you would need probably at least 2 full days in Sintra to kind of visit everything. And also the coast is only about 10, 15 minutes away, and there are beautiful beaches. And one thing that nobody knows about is that on one of the beaches on the hillside, there are dinosaur footprints. Just there.
Oh, interesting.
Everybody goes, oh, yeah, you mean the beach with the dinosaur footprints. Okay, I'll meet you there. Like, it's the future of the footprints. And I'm the only one who's going, don't you think it's amazing that there are dinosaur footprints here? Yeah. And you go there and you see the fishermen who are around there, you know, and you can see them fishing, and you ask them sort of, you know, about the dinosaur footprints, and they go, oh, yeah, all right, it's just down here. So that's a unique thing to go and visit.
Well, you talked about the fishermen. The sort of typical picture in my mind of the Portuguese seaside village with the brightly colored fishing boats and such, do you still see that much anymore? Or?
You do. There's certain areas mm-hmm. where they saturated it a bit, like going up north in Nazaré and towards Fatima. Fatima is a nightmare. I don't recommend anybody go there. I mean, unless you have great sort of religious intentions of going there, that's where the miracle, you know, took place, mm-hmm. the three shepherds. But otherwise, it's horrific. Tacky little shops everywhere. The place where the miracle, which was in a beautiful field at one stage, is now looks like some kind of Olympic stadium or something. People walking on their knees. It's whatever uplifting feeling you're meant to take from there. I certainly didn't feel it. It was rather much more depressing. But I suppose in itself, that makes it kind of fascinating to visit. But I don't recommend it unless you've got some kind of time to kill. But no, you do still see that. Going sort of more south, before you get to the Algarve, along what they call the Vicentine Coast, going from Lisbon towards the Algarve, all along that coast, you see that still. And frankly, in terms of if people come to Portugal, the one thing that, in terms of gastronomy, it's fantastic. We've got, in my mind, Spain and Portugal make much better wines for price quality than France or Italy. You know, people are drawn to it. But in France, to get a decent bottle of wine, you've got to pay 25, 30 euros. In Portugal, you can get a decent bottle of wine, probably better than the 30 bottle of wine you paid for in France, for like 7 euros.
Is there any particular wine we should look for if we're trying out Portuguese wine for the first time?
EA. That's the simplest one I can think of, which is delicious. It's okay. Got a blue and white label, and all it says in big letters is EA. And it's a fantastic red wine from the interior. Red wines from the Douro region up north, where the port wine is made, is also delicious. And that whole region is UNESCO World Heritage now, because it's stunningly beautiful. The way they grow the grapes on these terraced hillside really is unique, and it's all grown on shale. And the idea mm-hmm. is that the shale is reflective, so that it reflects onto the grapes, which makes the grapes even sweeter.
Hmm.
So depending on how the sun sets or rises on the grapes, it'll reflect from the shale up onto the grapes.
And as long as we're detouring a little into gastronomy there, anything else while we're in Portugal that we should make sure we don't miss?
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, okay. Grilled fish. Fantastic. You don't get better grilled fish than you do in Portugal. And I've traveled, and I've tried it for other places, but they just do it so well. It's so simple. Charcoal grill, come in sort of May, June, sardine time starts, little fat sardines are out, and they're grilling on the charcoal, and you can just smell it, and it's just salt, olive oil, whack it on the grill. They know how to grill it to perfection, so it's still moist on the inside and delicious. Absolutely delicious. Actually, they do fantastic grilled chicken as well. Anything on the grill. I don't know why. They do everything. Anything on the grill is delicious.
Okay.
But fish, particularly, for people who like seafood, shellfish, Portugal's a dream. We've got fresh Atlantic catch, which I think is in some ways better than Mediterranean. I think the waters on the Atlantic are cleaner. And I think the fish are more sort of robust.
Okay.
A little bit meatier than kind of flimsy Mediterranean fish.
You were,
and of course, codfish.
Talking about grilling sardines, and for me, the first question I have, well, not being a fish lover either, the second question I have is, you know, is there enough to eat on a sardine?
There is indeed, but you have to catch them at the right time. The one thing that's nice about Portugal is that food is seasonal, which I think is a healthy sign, because, you know, if you're getting food all year round that you normally only get a certain time of period, something's wrong. But sardines are only in the beginning of summer when they're nice and fat. Like sardines now, skinny, horrible little tiny things, not worth eating. But yeah, in the early summer, end of spring, fantastic little fat guys. Some people eat the whole thing. I can't do that. I have to kind of carefully take it apart, you know. And codfish as well is the national dish of Portugal. They say there are 365 different ways to cook fish here.
Well, that's appropriate.
I can believe it sometimes. I'm not a big fan of codfish myself. It's a pungent fish, and it's all salted cod here. So lots of people love it. I'm not particularly keen on it.
Okay.
And you say you're not a fish lover?
Eat a lot of fish as a kid. I think it's a reaction.
Oh. Well, we have grilled chicken. Grilled chicken's really
there you go.
Fantastic here. It is very good. And wines. Okay. Delicious wine. Oh, that's the other thing I was going to say about the wines, too. Not only do we get delicious red wines, but in the north, there's also a region where we grow green wine, which is where the grapes are picked very young. So it makes this fantastic, fresh, crisp wine, and it's delicious on a summer evening. It washes down your grilled chicken, my fish. Delicious. It's really stupendous.
What is that wine called?
Vingvir, green wine.
Green wine, okay.
I think you can get in the States Casal Garcia, which is, and I think you have that in like Trader Joe's or something like that, which is a green wine.
Okay.
These are what guests tell me. Well, I know the Portuguese wine, the only wine that a lot of people comment on is Matus. Matus, the one that comes in the kind of conical bottle, and Lancers. Those aren't good representations of Portuguese wine.
Okay. You don't
send us
the good wine.
We like to keep the good
wine.
Stuff ourselves.
The,
okay.
I find that's often the case with countries. I don't know why that is.
It's true. Well, your best market's your home market.
Okay. What's the next stop on our tour here?
Oh, it's difficult to say. The best thing, then you're kind of stuck in the middle because do you go north? Do you go south? If you have time, do both. If you go north, then there's Porto, which is the hometown of port wine. It's the second largest city in Portugal. The waterfront part of Porto has been made a UNESCO World Heritage.
Mm-hmm.
It's houses built on top of houses and, you know, all these sort of shady corners. But again, it's quite safe. And then on the other side of the river, so you have the sort of waterfront part, which is all sort of messy housing and everything, but somehow it's full of charm in the kind of messiness. And then on the other side of the river, you have what's called Vila Nova de Gaia, which is where all the port wine cellars are. And you look to the other side and you see Taylors, Grahams, Churchills, Coburn, all of them, the big producers.
Mm-hmm.
It's got that wonderful iron bridge that takes you across from one side of the river to the other. It's a beautiful city. And it's worth going to visit some of the cellars, the port wine cellars, to get an idea of the processes in making port wine. And, you know, to sample it and so on.
And is that the region, am I correct, where a lot of cork was coming from originally?
No. Cork comes from southeast of Lisbon.
Okay.
In the narrow region called the Alentejo, which is Portugal's biggest agricultural producing region, but it's also the poorest. But again, it's got a vastness to it, which is very appealing, and cork trees everywhere. And cork trees are so beautiful, sort of big and sprawling. And then in the springtime, it's fantastic to go and visit because it's full of wildflowers. The whole region there is full of wildflowers. And these little villages where they still, you know, you see them making the ceramics or making these rugs by hand. And you feel like you've sort of stepped back in time a little bit.
Hmm.
But that's where the cork is from. But no, up north is mainly the port wine. And then they did have for a while sort of a big textile industry. And they were very good at making fabrications of tools, specialized tools. But in terms of what I would go and visit, I would visit Porto, and then I'd follow the Douro River, which is the river that would carry the port wine from the grapes down to Porto by the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd follow the river, and you can take this wonderful cruise, or you can take a train that runs right along the river, and you're following the way of the grapes going up towards Pinhão, which is the hub of the port wine. You have the cellars in Porto, and then you have the quintas where the wine is made, or used to be made, not so much anymore, up where the grapes are. Follow the river on this cruise with fantastic views of these terraced valleys of vineyards, and you can see that you can go and visit various quintas, the Grahams and the Taylors place.
Okay.
That's definitely worth doing. It's a beautiful valley.
Okay.
And then if you go south from Lisbon, again, there's a lot to see. As you're following south, you're sort of following the way of the explorers, you know, the great Portuguese explorers like Vasco da Gama and Ferdinand Magellan and Diogo Cão and, you know, all the chaps who discovered the world for us. And you're following along the coastline there, and it's the Atlantic coast here is rugged and rough. And you can see why these guys were scared, but you can also feel why they were so inspired to go out there. So much of Portugal is coastline. Couldn't help but to imagine they want to know what's out there. And then you can go and visit the school of Henry the Navigator.
I was wondering,
he himself kind of never went on a boat, but he was very inspired for other people. No, you go. I'll stay here. again, it's right on the tip. It's on the Cape of St. Vincent. The Mediterranean meets the Atlantic, and it's just beautiful. And they have what they call the Rose Compass, which is a huge compass on the ground, and it's this great white fort sitting on the Cape. And you really feel, you know, certain points in the world have high energy. This is one of those points.
Okay.
It definitely is. And supposedly Columbus studied there, and various other great explorers studied there. So that's worth visiting. And then the Algarve itself, which is what Portugal's best known for, sure. Unfortunately, tourism has done the worst down there. Faro, forget it. God, it's a nightmare. High-rise buildings, kind of English Lagerlaut tourists or German tourists. It's kind of split between Germany and England.
So is there someplace you go instead, for instance, if you wanted to go relax in the sun?
I would go down to, the farthest I would go down to is Lagos, which is, you have the Cape of St. Vincent, and then you go to be on the Mediterranean. You go a little way, and you hit the first town you sort of hit is Lagos, and that's a walled town. Historically, it's known for having Portugal's first slave market. Always fascinating to go and visit. And it also is where a lot of the big caravels set sail from. So it has this big harbor.
Caravels, merchant ships.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's still got the old part of town. It looks a lot like what you imagine perhaps a town in North Africa would look like, in Morocco or something.
Okay.
And it's got that feel to it. And the people in the Algarve look different from every region. People look or sound slightly different. And the Algarve, they're kind of tall and lean, much darker skinned, little eyes, quite striking people. Hard to cover so much of Portugal.
Sure. Well, what's your favorite part of Portugal? We've talked about a couple different ones there. What place do you go to and think, thank God I grew up in Portugal?
I would have to say the Alentejo, where all the cork trees are, because that is so beautiful.
Interesting. Okay.
And sort of
unique.
Yeah, and you don't get the tourist crowds down there at all. Uh-huh. And you have all this wonderful wineries. And there, for a meat eater, that's the place you want to go. you get the delicious black pig type prosciutto ham.
Oh, okay.
And it's delicious. It's so good. I will say the thing is with Portuguese food, it's not particularly pretty, but it's very tasty.
Okay.
But that's the region I think I probably most love. I like being on the coast as well, but it's just got a kind of feel to it that's very special out there.
And before we wrap up, tell us a little more, because you have a particular way that you recommend to see Portugal, I would imagine.
Of course, by bicycle. What else? That's right. As you said when you introduced me, we have this company, Cycling Through the Centuries. It was originally my mother's back in the 80s, and I'm now running it. We've been in business for about 20 years, and we love to show people Portugal, Spain. It's our specialty, the Iberian Peninsula. A little bit of France, but we like to keep it to what we know. Bicycling, I think, is one of the best ways to travel. And we are very specialized in what we do. So if you do come to Portugal and you do want to go by bike, I hope people will look us up.
Now, the only question I have is, so I love biking. My favorite form of exercise. But Portugal's got a lot of mountains.
No, mountains, come on. We don't have mountains.
Hills, at least.
We don't even have, like, a ski area.
Okay, there you go.
No, it is hilly. I mean, the Iberian Peninsula is hilly. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish I could take a big rolling pin to it, but it's not bad. It's not very difficult. It really isn't. And I would say that Portugal cycling is easier than our Spain trips in general. Cycling the coast of Portugal is a lot easier than... It's probably the easiest trip we do in terms of terrain and everything else and distance traveled and so on.
Okay. And you do a lot of tours, and certainly some are going to be a better match for different people. But what's your favorite?
Well, it's difficult to say, you know, people ask that and it's really hard. I don't know what my favorite is. You know, you love them all for different reasons. Like you say, some are more historical, some are more scenic, some are more, some have a little bit of everything. In Portugal, I'd have to say it was probably going down Portugal's blue coast, starting in Lisbon and then coasting down.
Down to Lagos.
Just because you get so much of it. And then second would be the Alentejo region.
Okay.
Because, again, it's beautiful.
One last question for you. Biggest surprise people are going to have when they go to Portugal?
The people. The Portuguese people. Lord Byron didn't have much to say about him, but he was so wrong.
So Lord Byron's an idiot, really, is what we're saying.
Completely. I mean, he was just, you know, colonialist pig. But Portugal is So the biggest surprise we have, and I'll say that we have people that'll do a trip with us in Spain, and then they'll do a trip with us in Portugal. And the first thing they mention is how nice, not sort of in comparison to the Spaniards, but just how much more approachable the Portuguese are. They're not sort of flamboyant and on top of you like the Italians are, you know, where you know it's, you know, quite superficial, but they're being super friendly and everything. And the Spanish are more kind of sanguinary and passionate people and a little bit more aggressive in their approach to you. But the Portuguese are very humble people, very modest, conservative. You know, they have their formalities. And, you know, whenever I've had a problem with my bike or I've been stuck in some situation, invariably somebody will come out and then they'll try to help me. They'll dedicate their time to trying to help me. And everybody's had this experience. You don't speak any Portuguese. Portuguese is a very difficult language. And you come out here and they'll try to speak English. They'll try to understand you. They make an effort because unlike when you go to certain places and they expect you to speak their language, even though you're only on holiday for a week, you didn't really have time to learn it. Here they make an effort. They really do. I think that's the biggest surprise people have is how genuine the people are. Kind, helpful, and very unassuming. Very unassuming.
Any last comments about your home country?
I would come now to Portugal because I think it's one of these places that it's really going to be discovered. And I hope it does because I think it's fantastic for the economy. On the other hand, if you got a chance to see it now and to see parts of Portugal now, I'd come now.
Well, thanks very much for coming on the show, Catherine. And again, our guest is Catherine from Cycling Through the Centuries. And I'll put a link to their website on the show notes. And thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
I have two internet resources for you today. The first one is Fast Check from arrivalguides.com, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And Fast Check has free travel guides for numerous destinations, including Lisbon, which we talked about today. The guides do have advertising in them to support them. But from what I can see, they look like they have some useful information. So you might check that out in the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. And the second resource is an interactive map of Europe, which comes from the visiteurope.com website. I'll put a link to that also. It could be useful in planning a trip to Portugal or somewhere else in Europe. Links to both of those resources at amateurtraveler.com. I'm not going to do a lot of news in the community today because I'm trying to wrap this up before I go to Mexico with a group called Esperanza and a church group tomorrow to build houses. If you're interested in more about that, check it way back in the Wayback Machine to episode 11. For those of you on iTunes, you won't find episode 11 in iTunes. You'll have to get that from the episode guide on the website. So if you're interested in knowing more about what I am doing, check that out. I did just spend last weekend at the Podcast and New Media Expo talking podcasting with numerous podcasters, both well-known and obscure, and had just a wonderful time. And thanks to all of you who told me you listened to the show or used it to plan a trip. That was a lot of fun. Wes, who is known to those of you on the discussion boards as Adidas Orange, put in a comment on the New Mexico episode, episode 106. He says, I want to reiterate that Carlsbad is awesome. If you make plans to go well in advance and are in reasonable shape, seriously look into the Wild Cave Tour. The tours are very, very limited, but extremely rewarding. I went in 2002, and they only allowed 800 people a year into the side cavern, 3 to 4 hours, some very tight places. The Wild Cave Tour hits a portion of the cave that still has some of the original footprints from the first explorers in the side passage decades ago. As for the bat program, I went in late April. The bats are just beginning their nightly exodus at that time of year. Don't expect the National Park Rangers to tell you that, though. They prefer you to think the bats aren't there until the summer. They even go as far as to lie about it to protect the bats. I was in disbelief, but hey, it is the government. The White Sands is nice. Great Sand Dunes National Park in Colorado is better, though. The sand is the most amazing shade of white, gypsum. The mountains just east of Carlsbad, White Sands, are a nice drive as well. You would never expect the wooded terrain, considering the arid desert below. Thanks so much for entering your comment. I hope the rest of you will take the opportunity to send me a line at host@amateurtraveler.com or leave a comment on this or any episode or enter into the discussion on the discussion boards at amateurtraveler.com/board. And as always, thanks so much for listening.
one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home, but maybe not today.
The best and the brightest, served up daily by the sharpest minds in content delivery, Podshow and Limelight.